Hello and welcome again to another Challenger Cities podcast. I had an idea for this one, which was, as this second series has shifted away from Toronto, when we started out doing this as a specifically Toronto thing, let's go back and get somebody who is relatively fresh to Toronto and really go through how Toronto is or is not and could be a Challenger City through their eyes. I had dinner with someone who would be perfect for this, and thankfully he was voluntold into doing it. His name's Arthur Smith. He works for the massive global micro-mobility business called Lime. You've seen their scooters and bikes, I'm sure, albeit they're not in Toronto. He moved to the city back in August, having spent most of his time in the States in various places before that. So I thought it'd be really good to go and get the perspective of somebody who's relatively fresh to the city, how they see it, what it does well, what it could do better. And there's loads that it does well, and there's loads that it could do better. Rather than having my tired old voice who moved away. So this is a great conversation with Arthur Smith, and get into it.
Cultural.
Nice.
Arthur, thank you for this. I really want to talk to you because you're someone who has moved to Toronto as I've moved away from Toronto. And I thought after starting this series originally all around like how to make Toronto a better place for people who are sort of like less conventional urbanists, a guy who works in micro-mobility, he moved from the States to Toronto, where we don't really have a lot of micro-mobility, you're kind of perfect. I want to talk to you about your experience moving up, like your like how you think about cities, like a little bit about micro-mobility. Before we go into that, I'd love to have you like introduce yourself in your own words versus the ones I voiced upon you.
Sure. Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here and chat about all these things. Yeah, so I live in Toronto now. I moved here in about August of last year. I had been living in the Washington, D.C. area since about 2014. Before that, I had lived in Baltimore, and I'd also lived in Florida and a bunch of different places. I really like soccer, and I love cooking and traveling. And I really also am interested in micromobility and making cities more sustainable and more people and bike friendly. I've been working in micromobility for about 3 years. Before that, I worked for a bunch of nonprofit organizations. And I always, when I was younger, I really loved trains, and I've always loved trains. And so since I've been working at Lime, I've kind of rediscovered, but realized that I am very passionate about transit and mobility. And so I've gotten way more into all those things, both personally and at work too. And so that's a little bit about myself.
I feel there's a thing about an American that like actually like train culture is something that exists some like deep in the American psyche, but it just has to like break through the surface. It's almost like I was talking to one guy who was like, I've never been on a train. Actually, no, it's a lie. I went on a train at Disneyland, and then he just got obsessed with everything about trains. And it was kind of like repressed inside his soul. So anyway, we'll dig into the trains.
Yeah, well, it's you know, the thing about it is that there are certain areas that have a lot more trains than others. So like the Northeast U.S., from D.C. to Boston, you have pretty much every city has a regional rail system. So you have Amtrak that's like connecting the cities, and then DC, Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, they all have a variation of either regional rail or subway. And that's pretty distinct in the sense of it's only the Northeast Corridor, Chicago, San Francisco, and LA, a lot of the US. There are lots of freight trains that go across the country, but I think it's only in certain cities that you have such an extensive transit network. But I think it's the kind of thing where once a person has a good experience on a train, they really like it. Like I think Brightline is a great example in Florida where it's doing super well, ridership is growing. And there's another Amtrak line that was just launched, I think in Minnesota between St. I don't know exactly where it is. It's somewhere in Minnesota in the Great Lakes area where
to the Minnesota. It's like Minneapolis or St. Paul to Chicago or something.
Something like that. Yeah. And like it's doing super well, exceeding kind of all the projections in terms of ridership. So I think it's one of those things where people, if given the opportunity, you really like it.
Yeah. Like I sort of, the first time I went on the Acela, the power lines went down. I was late to a meeting. On the way back from that meeting that didn't go very well because we were late to the meeting, going from like New York to Wilmington, on the way back, something happened. Like, I think a cow got hit by a train and like the whole line got shut down. So it was like my first experience of Amtrak was like, oh God. But yeah, like actually it's reasonably good.
Oh yeah.
I want to go into your experience moving to Canada. So like having spent a lot of time in DC, long time in DC and then Baltimore and like Florida, like why Toronto? Like what made you go like, that's where I want to be. And what's the experience been like moving up here?
Sure. Yeah. So I've been coming to Ontario pretty much my whole life, and my family has as well, to visit and for a vacation. And then I have family that's in Toronto. And so I would always visit them every summer and have been doing that for probably 20, 25 years. And so I became very familiar with Ontario, mostly Southern Ontario, and of course, Toronto itself. And I think it was 2021, 22. So first, I would say it's always been a place I wanted to live. I was like Toronto, Los Angeles, and then more recently, Paris and London have been on my list. But now I think I felt that I didn't really want to live in the U.S. anymore. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel like there was such an alignment with my values and the kind of society that I want to live in and have a family in, raise children and live with my wife in. And so in about 2022, my wife and I were talking about it, and I think we both agreed that we first wanted to live internationally because we always wanted to do that, and we've both have had the ability to study abroad, so that makes a difference. And we both were in agreement that we wanted to move, and so we went back and forth of a few different places, thinking about Paris, thinking about Los Angeles, thinking about Toronto, and then settled on that we don't want to be in the U.S. And Europe is very attractive. It's just that it's a little bit further. Like a flight from Toronto to New York is only 1 hour, or DC is 1 hour, where our families are. And so it was about in 2022 when we really started planning. In 2023, in the summer, we came up and we looked at a few apartments. And then in about summer 2023, late 2023 is when we actually started the planning in terms of, you know, starting to put our house available to be rented out in Maryland, and started to look at all the passport and permanent residency details and documents and all of that. And then planning the date and the time and the kind of stages by which we would get here. And then starting to sell things. And so it took a while. Like the actual process takes a while. And then even when we moved out of our house, we traveled actually for a good amount of time. We spent about a month in Europe, and then we also stayed in New York before we eventually came here and stayed in an Airbnb for the first 2 months. And then we moved into an apartment the first week of November. And now we're working on permanent residency and all that stuff. And so it's been a lot of work, but I think it didn't feel like such a new or different place, like a place we'd never been to before, because I've been here so much. So that part was not so hard.
How does it compare to, like, I have an impression of Maryland in my mind because I spent the summer in Bowie, which I annoyed everybody by pronouncing it Bowie.
But Bowie, like, is right. That's how you pronounce it, actually.
Yeah, I know. I just like annoying people by saying it wrong. But like, to me, like that bit of the world, like Toronto, actually, like even though it's not very far, even though it's culturally like relatively like sort of close in some ways, it feels like another world in others. How have you found, like, now you live in Toronto, like what are the things that have struck you about the city for better or worse?
Sure. I would say that before we lived in Maryland, we had been living in DC, in the pretty central part of DC, where you don't, for a lot of things, you don't need a car. So we lived there, and then we moved to Maryland to some more suburban area that was about 10 minutes away from the city, but where you really had to have a car to get around. It's very car-centric. It's not very friendly to biking. There are trails here and there, and there's a subway. But even then, it's not super, I'm not as convenient as I feel transit is here. And so I think we had the experience of living in the city center, and then living in a suburban area where we needed a car to get around. And after a few years, realizing that's not for us. Like, we want to be able to walk everywhere. We want to have a variety of shops and things to do, places to eat. And in suburbs, I think in most suburbs that I've lived in, number one, you do have to drive everywhere, which I think is very lonely. And very, it makes it easier to disconnect and be isolated from other people. And then the second part is that there isn't as much variety in terms of local and small businesses. In wealthy areas, there's a little bit more variety, but there's also in a lot of suburbs, there's not. There's a lot of chain restaurants. Where I went to college, was a more rural area, and there were a lot of chain restaurants, drive-through restaurants there. And so I would say that's one of the things that's different in terms of the layout and geography. I think culturally, I would say Canadians in general, I feel, are way more polite. And like, I'll give you an example. Really, where I'm sitting right now, I'm looking out in kind of like a driveway and alley in front of where I live. There was a car that was driving in the snow and got stuck. A guy was in his house, and I can see, and he came out of his house fully dressed, helped the person move the car, get it out. The driver, and so they got the car out. Then the driver stopped and got out to offer the guy money. And the guy was like, no, it's okay. And this guy was in his house. He wasn't outside. I already have a bunch of stories like that, that just have a sense of trust and politeness and respect that I didn't experience in the US, no matter really where I lived.
I'm disappointed he was offered money and not a donut, but you know.
Exactly. I mean, there was another time this summer where I was with my wife at like a laundromat in a more rural part of Ontario. And I told her I was going to Tim Hortons to get a coffee and then I'll come back. And she was in the middle of a conversation with someone. And the person she was in the conversation with, who was a stranger at the laundromat, was like, oh, here's $5. Can you get me something? I was like, okay, I've never seen that. You know, it's just, and this is someone I literally just met 5 minutes before. So I think there's a much more empathetic culture and a culture of politeness here. It's also the suburbs in Maryland in particular, I feel are quite segregated, which isn't really, and segregated in terms of intentional physical boundaries, like the creation of highways that were meant to segregate people by both race and income, which doesn't really, you know, I think it doesn't really exist here in the same way.
Yeah. There's something kind of interesting around like the stereotype of Canadian niceness is wild. But like Toronto is also the place where like you probably see that less than anywhere else. Like if you go to New Brunswick or Alberta, people like talk about people from Toronto being a bit cold and a bit mean. But it's like it's in relation to,
yeah, exactly,
other places.
No, but I mean, I did it too. The other day I was walking by Liberty Village, and there was a woman who was carrying two really heavy chairs to like her apartment. And I was walking by there with my cousin and I was like, we should help her. So I just carried one of the chairs like three blocks. And then I was like, okay, this is as far as I can go. So, you know, I think it's way more of a collectivist culture, which I think is also reflected in the policies that exist here that don't exist in the US around healthcare. I mean, there's many examples.
Is it like there's an interesting thing of sort of like the American side of hospitality, like having an English accent really has helped me wherever I've gone in America.
Mm.
But it's often like the sort of a stranger, but who knows somebody you know, gets incredible hospitality. But like a total stranger, depending on where you are, it's not necessarily so ubiquitous. And I think there's an interesting sort of lens of how you apply that in different places, how they do sort of social cohesion and niceness and friendliness in different ways.
I think you're right. I think if you're a friend of a friend, or yeah, I think that really makes a difference. But if you're just a stranger, you know, it's not, at least in my experience, it's not as friendly.
Yeah. So in terms of like moving to this, like as a city, like what surprised you about Toronto? What's the sort of things that you're like, I didn't expect that. I thought this would be like work in a different way, like whether they're good things or bad things or frustrations. Like it's nice to have positives and also things you vent about. About Toronto enough.
So I think it would be helpful to explain. So I lived in Baltimore for about a year and a half. I lived in Miami. I lived in Tampa, Florida. I lived in D.C. I also lived in Buenos Aires, Argentina for like 5 months doing study abroad. So I have the experience of living in a lot of cities, and then I've also visited many cities across the U.S. and fortunately across the world. And so I think the things that have surprised me but that I really like, personally, I really love the streetcar system. I think having, even yes, it could be improved, but having the ability to to just walk out of your door and then get on what is the equivalent of a on-street train that can take you, you know, to different neighborhoods. It can take you, it can connect you to the subway, it can connect you to buses, it can take you to all different places. I think that really makes a huge difference and is extremely valuable for the city, especially myself having lived in places, in cities in particular, that don't have subways, that don't have subways that expand beyond certain areas, cities that are very car dependent, cities that have a bus system that doesn't function super well, and then also cities that have a lot of huge or very, you know, these kind of big barriers of segregation. And like in DC, Rock Creek Park is a good example. In Baltimore, there's the Highway 83, which goes right through the middle of the city, and many others. And having the ability to take a streetcar from, you know, on Dundas Street and go 10 kilometers all the way east, you know, to the Don Valley, or if you go on Queen Street and you go all the way out east past the beaches, like, just I think is really valuable for the city. And so that I think super exciting. I really like that. The other part is the quietness and how quiet it is, in particular in the area that I'm in, especially during rush hour. And I think that's a combination of when you create opportunities for people to live in a way that doesn't require a car, you realize that cars make cities so much louder and much more unpleasant experiences. Like I live off of King Street, and during rush hour, even though I'm pretty close to the downtown area, it's really not that loud. There's not so many cars versus other cities I lived in the US where during rush hour, it's like a highway in the city, super crowded, tons of cars, trucks, bus, everything, just making it not just obviously very loud, but also it's not good for the environment. And so I think Toronto does a really good job of creating and making more and more areas where people are not dependent on a car, because I think that's a unique experience to be walking down the street in the middle of a city that has 3 million people and realize, oh, this is actually really quiet. It's quite enjoyable. We're like on the sidewalk. We can hear other people's conversations. You don't hear lots of honking, which I think is actually probably what a lot of Manhattan is experiencing now with congestion pricing below 60th Street. You're starting to see, and this kind of, I have had this experience in other cities, mostly in Europe. Like in this past year, we went to Nice, went to Paris, a bunch of cities where they've done a really good job of making more pedestrian and bike friendly, and you don't need to have a car, which results in fewer cars on the street, which means it feels way more human centric and it feels way more like focused on just people and maximizing people's lives and making things as good as possible. And so I think Toronto does a good job of that, at least in a lot of the areas that I've been to. And then the third thing that I really like is the waterfront. You know, the Gardner, I hope it's torn down. That would be wonderful. However, the difference is that in the US, the Gardner would be literally on the water. Like there would be no Coronation Park. There would be no, the music park, Quayside, Trillium Park, like the highways in the U.S. would be right there, as close to the water as possible. So the fact that you can get on a bike with Toronto's bike share system and you can bike from Trillium Park all the way to Tommy Thompson Park along the water with virtually no interruption is incredible to me. I mean, there's not many places that I've been to. Paris has something like that along the Seine, but that's only because there was a highway tunnel that they just got rid of the highway and they converted it into a bike.
You hit on sort of interesting things. I think people here who have been in Toronto a long time don't necessarily appreciate. So I think there's like a streetcar thing of like lots of people will complain about the streetcars because they see them as like the big things and like with a traffic jam behind it. But often it's a streetcar that's stuck behind a car. The noise thing I think is interesting because like downtown Toronto is like, it looks like if you said to a 5-year-old, draw a city, they would probably draw that skyline of big high buildings. But it doesn't have, it's not a tremendously noisy city compared to like a Manhattan. I've been to Lake Manhattan with congestion charging, it's becoming more quiet. But like Toronto is relatively quiet. It doesn't have like a huge amount of like noise compared to other places, especially with like the lack of highways, like crisscrossing a city like most American ones. And then the waterfront, I think, is like, you'll have Toronto types that love to like say, oh my God, our waterfront is like one of the best in the world. And you'll have other Toronto types that will like criticize it because it's not got some sort of big, sexy attraction on it. And I think that you've hit three things that are like, in my opinion, is like Toronto does those things quite well, but it could do them all way better. You're starting from this foundation that's quite positive, and mm-hmm. we're actually fortunate to have it compared to many places that don't.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I think it's relative, right? It's all depending on your perspective and what you've seen. And you know, I think even if you take London, for example, if you go along the river from Kensington, Chelsea area to the London Eye, you have you have a waterfront, but you mostly have like a pretty narrow sidewalk and then roads. You don't have extended space. There's nothing like Coronation Park. There's nothing like Trillium Park.
Yeah.
Now, you know, when you get to the London Eye, you can keep going and there's paths, but it's not, I think it's done really well here. I went to Nice, which is on the water, on the Mediterranean. I went to Lisbon, which is also on the water. And the only thing that I would like to see, I mean, I would love to see more of would be to make more pedestrian only areas along the water. And, you know, that would, and there are certain areas, like when you go east of the airport, it's really just like the streetcar and there's like one lane for cars, which means there aren't many cars. And so I think the quietness is actually a really great complement of the fact that so many people are taking the GO train into downtown Toronto or taking the subway. Like, and the traffic is mainly on Jarvis Street and these other streets that are mostly like an on-ramp to the highway downtown, but only at certain hours. And so it's done a really great job, I think, of creating a central point, which is like Union Station in the downtown area. And then if you look at a map, you see all of the GO train lines end there, the subway ends there, all of the streetcars go through there. They might not end there, but they go through there. And so it actually is set up perfectly for congestion pricing, which I hope we get to next, because it could be done quite easily and it makes the most sense. Because the reason why it's worked so well in Manhattan is because similarly, all of the regional rail in the New York area ends at Penn Station or Grand Central. I mean, the same way that there's millions of people that take the GO train into Union Station. And so, yeah, I think it is interesting to see, like you said, some of the perspectives and critiques of the things that could be better and the things that could be improved. And I think that's all generally in the right direction. And part of it is, these are things that cities like Stockholm and Paris and Madrid have already done, and it makes the city more vibrant and enjoyable for everyone. It also creates a lot of stimulus in the sense of people want to go and visit. Like if Queen Street was pedestrianized, like you have all of those, there's a whole fashion district. Like you'd start to have way more visitors. I mean, it's great already. I love it. I love the area. But I think part of it is the people who are seeing what's happening in other parts of the world and know that Toronto can do it. It's just happening very slowly, so it's very frustrating.
There's like a really interesting thing of that when you talk about places like Nice, like when you see French cities that have trams, very, very rarely do those trams share any space with cars.
Exactly.
And then you can have a street that is like pedestrian. I have always talked to you about this week, but they talked about like Toronto like has, you can't have a street that has six different uses on it.
Right, right.
But you can have a street that has probably five. It's just the sixth one that you lose is the car. Once you have the car on it, it's quite hard to have a tram. It's quite hard to be pedestrian. It's quite hard to bike. It's quite hard to have a cafe on it. Whereas if you have like those squares where like you actually don't need any physical infrastructure that blocks the pedestrian from the tram, because you might have like a little bit of like textured or colored surfacing.
Then that's something that you could do, and they're doing that actually on. Oh, what is the street? There's a street downtown. They've been doing construction on it, and they basically are painting. They've painted the road red where the streetcar will go. And then on one side of it is a bike lane. So they actually might be making it into kind of like one way for cars only and then protected. But yeah, Nice is a good example where a lot of the tram route is protected. And I'm trying to think of, yeah, Madrid has a big subway system. I don't think they have a tram there, though.
No, Madrid's subway is amazing because it's completely utilitarian. There's no interesting train. There is no interesting seating. There is no interesting architecture. But because of that, they built a massive subway system quite quickly.
Right, right.
There's an interesting lesson in that. But like, it's sort of like interesting that Toronto has the, like, I think like the waterfront is a great, like the like waterfront plus streetcars is like fascinating because it's like, if you have those two things and then you have the space for the bikes and you have the space for pedestrians and you have the space for cafes, you end up with a city that you would want to go on holiday to and just hang out.
Exactly.
And it's so close.
And I think that's the thing that... So the big geographical difference is that Toronto has a huge flat area along the water, along a huge kind of waterfront that feels more like an ocean than like a pond, right? And so there aren't many cities in the world that are fortunate to have that. And one example of one I've been to a bunch of times is Lisbon, which does mm-hmm. have a nice waterfront. It has some pedestrianized areas, cafes as well you can visit. But it's also, if you go up, it's sloping. But having the pedestrian-only areas along the water make it super popular all the time. And Toronto actually has, in my opinion, an even better setup because it has this really flat, very slightly sloping waterfront where you could have more restaurants and cafes, and you could really make it for people only. And then more and more people would come because you can walk along the waterfront. You could stay at the hotel down there. You can go to the restaurants and the bars. And I just wish that, in particular, the city council would realize the potential there, that like other cities, in particular in the U.S., if you think about that, have put a highway right along the water, way closer than what we have. Then the other major cities, London, Paris, Madrid, which have a river running through them. But there aren't many cities that are kind of oceanfront or lakefront in the same way of Toronto that really could take advantage of this by making way more of the waterfront only for pedestrians and, just like you said, a streetcar. And one of the things that was amazing to me is that in France, you can take the train from Marseille to some, and it runs right along the waterfront, and it uh-huh. there's a train stop that is right next to a beach.
Yeah.
Like a beach that's unbelievably beautiful, that looks incredible, that is famous and all the actors and celebrities live there. You could just take a train and get off right there. And it just makes it so that people do go, actually, because you can go for the day. And same way for Toronto, if and I feel like we have a lot of the good setup, and there's just more that needs to be done and realizing of that potential.
Have you ever driven in that bit of France in the summer?
No, I have.
Awful. It's a giant parking lot. So you end up intelligent, it doesn't really matter. People who are I can just take the train to the beach, I'd be a moron to take my car. It's not like the train is the option for the people who can't afford a car.
Right. And so to me, the if you could have it so that you get to Union Station and then you have a pedestrian only walkway to St. Lawrence Market, like Esplanade, you could make that a pedestrian only, and then you would have pedestrian only down to the water. It would be the same kind of thing. People would come into the city and they're like, oh, I could spend the whole day by the waterfront. There's going to be, if there's people, there's going to be people want to play music. People want to set up food stands. You just create all of these new opportunities for people to do what they love to do, which is going to bring more money to local businesses, which is going to bring more visitors, more tourism. And there's all these conversations going on now about there's a Toronto Star article about how Queen Street is dead and the fashion district's dying. And it's but there's plenty of other places in the world that have pedestrianized their streets and they're crowded year round, even Stockholm in the winter. Yeah. It's colder than here.
There's a real estate thing as well to this. I've noticed this since moving to Montreal. There's a lot of dépanneurs that have closed out. And partly because there's sort of too many of them. There's only so many places that you need to go out and grab some milk. And I'm sure things like DoorDash have done them in as well. But it's sort of interesting of a lot of those, you need to have the place that's affordable to vend from. So a lot of the lower margin places have closed down because it's not so affordable to sell low margin stuff. But you go down the Queen Street West, or you go down the waterfront, a lot of the places that you can sell, that you can use as a restaurant or use as a store, they're becoming bigger boxes that then the rents are higher. And actually, you need more experimental places to vend from, because that's what makes a space cool. And I think Williamsburg in New York did that amazingly well. And then a lot of as soon as Chipotle moved in, you were like, oh, bang goes the neighborhood. It's gone from being cool to being kind of nice.
100%.
But you need to have that mix, effectively. And part of that mix comes about by you can't have the cheaper experimental places to vend if you don't have the transit and the neighborhood vibe that brings people to them in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And there's actually, I feel like Lisbon, along the waterfront, they have people who set up a stand and they make like a homemade margarita. And then there's all these little things that bring people to the place that if they're driving is way harder. Or like they could drive and then walk, but you need to have that space that is somewhat less regulated, as long as, you know, the vendors are following the regulations around food safety. But there's actually a great example right around the corner from where I live. There's a place called Drew's Creations, and they do different types of Jamaican patties. They do jerk chicken and all this stuff. And they basically started out with like a little stand outside of a house where they sell their food every night. And they've done super well. They were up there on Instagram. They have a ton of followers. Now they were in BlogTO, and now they've moved kind of across the street, and they have a little bit of a bigger, similar kind of cart. But it's the kind of business that, like, if you give people the opportunity to produce those kinds of things and whatever it may be, it could be music, it could be food, it could be arts and crafts, and you eliminate the cost of rent, which is the highest cost, especially in a city where people are competing for space. You're going to create this vibrancy, and you're just going to create a place where all different kinds of people come out and do what they love to do. And it makes cities more beautiful, more exciting. And then it also creates more, it makes it more attractive for new businesses, because someone's like, okay, I see they're opening, you know, they've got this patty stand right here. I'm going to open this place over here. And they see that, you know, and the reality is that cars don't shop. Cars only park. Like St. Lawrence Market is really great because there's tons of people shopping. It's not like the cars go in and shop. And so when we're using, we need to really rethink how we're using space, in particular public space. Like if you have 6 parking spaces and instead you extend the sidewalk and allow for 3 restaurants to open, you know, 6 sets of tables, suddenly you've got 50 people eating where there were 6 cars, which were doing absolutely nothing. And that's another thing I think where there's momentum in Toronto to do that. It's just catching up to like the other cities that have already done it. So I'm super excited about that. I think there's great people in the city who are pushing in that direction. There's all kinds of organizations that related to placemaking. There's one called Plaza Pops that's focused on, you know, getting strip malls and shopping malls to be new and kind of similar design, similar attractive spaces. So there's a lot of good energy and momentum towards that and towards improving transit, which is one of the reasons that I was excited to move here.
There's like an interesting thing here of like the story of like ice cream. So there's an ice cream shop that people love to talk about in, I think it's San Francisco, that never opened because it took them years and years of zone. Like they applied to open an ice cream shop and some of the local residents complained because they were like, well, that'll bring kids and kids will bring noise and that'll be disruptive and it'll damage the net. So like, I think it was after 3 years, the ice cream, like the person who wants to open it was just like, I've run out of money. I can't even open it. And that the store is still derelict and it's not a good thing. Toronto is not that bad, but like it has you'll see sort of somebody has taken a lease on a place and it'll have a sign above it and it'll be like, coming soon, new interesting ethnic restaurant. It can often take quite a long time to open. And then by the time it does open, they've racked up all this cost. So maybe like, the pick a thing, like the sort of momos on the menu end up being a couple of dollars more than they were originally planned to be because it's sort of catching up from all this debt cost that they have. And then people go, oh, they were good momos, but like I wouldn't necessarily pay that much. It's like you don't get you start almost from like this thing of like you've got a bit of a ball and chain on you before you even like manage to like get up and run it.
Yeah, exactly. And
I think Toronto's getting better for that, but
yeah, I think you're right. I think that's a huge cost, a huge obstacle. And like one of the things that I really love about Toronto is that there are so many local and small businesses, so much variety, and the chain restaurants generally are doing the worst. And like that's way different than the US. Like outside of New York City, the variety of different restaurants here, I mean, there's, you know, on one street, you could have a place that does shawarma, and then next to it is a place that does, you know, roasted nuts. Like, and then another across the street is a place with Colombian food. I mean, that's fortunately where it's not too far from me. But I think that there has to be, and we've seen it. There was a corner store, I forgot where it was like the public wanted to shut it down. It was in another Toronto neighborhood. Then it got attention on Twitter, and then the council members allowed it to open up. And it's like, you know, what I think what people need to a lot of these places will bring incredible value and benefit to the community. It's just there's that initial hesitation, or like you said, the initial obstacles of real estate costs, things that make it more expensive to open, and then things close down because they can't survive. And it's like, actually, if you have a parking lot, like a lot of these green pea parking lots, if you just even take half of that parking lot and allow vendors to operate, you know, on the weekends, like you're going to create, it's going to be more exciting for everyone there. Even the people who originally were opposed to it, because they're like, oh, now I can go walk and I like walking, you know, versus having to drive and park and the stress of traffic. It's like, oh, it's in your neighborhood. You can walk there. It's an open air market. You've got different vendors selling different food. And my hope is that the city council will realize that reducing those obstacles will really benefit everyone in the city, especially entrepreneurs and many people who maybe have a great idea or a great thing they want to do, but just the cost of renting is too high.
There's a really interesting thing in the US at the moment of like red states and blue states getting things built. And it's like Texas does an amazing job at building housing because it's basically free of a load of housing regulations.
Right. Austin's a good example as well.
Yeah. And we can argue whether it's the right housing, and we can argue about how cities get built and stuff like that. But it's sort of like a loads of people want to move to Austin because you can build houses and you can run a business from there. And it's still a bit of a blue dot in a sea of red. And I think like that's the sort of thing that you then have all these blue states like New York and California probably being the best examples of like there's so much regulation to sort of get through to go and build anything. But at the end of the day, the consensus is, wouldn't we like more walkability? Wouldn't we like more transit? Wouldn't we like sort of more vending opportunities? And I think it's like bridging that gap of like getting to that mindset of like, you know what? Like, it's far better to say yes 10 times and be wrong once than to sort of say no 99 times and hope that you're right the other time.
Yeah.
I think that that's the sort of thing to get over.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the places that people love to visit the most in the US for Americans is Disney World. And literally, it's an entirely walkable place. You've got all different types of restaurants and vendors, and you can go on the roller coasters. And it's like, you know, like why let's you can make the cities like that, and they do exist around the world. And I think part of it is just, you know, do you have the experience? If you're an elected official in Toronto, do you actually, like, do you know that this is possible? Have you seen it? Have you been to these cities? Like, get on a, you know, there's nonstop flights from Toronto to Lisbon. It's only a few hours. Like, go there and see what it's like along their waterfront. And I just think it's something that could be done quite easily and would be really beneficial. It's just a matter of the political courage to do it. Similarly with congestion pricing, there was all this, like, opposition to it, and in my opinion, it was a very loud minority of people that were opposed to it. And now if you look at the polling, it's actually quite supportive, which is the same thing in London, Singapore, Stockholm, all the cities that do it, because it really works. And so I think it's similar to a bunch of issues in Toronto around, you know, making the city more pedestrian friendly, more bike friendly, reducing parking, which I think in a lot of the center parts of the city, we should really be removing on-street parking and widening sidewalks. Like all the major east-west streets, in my opinion, that should be like one of the first things we do, is remove the on-street parking probably between Bathurst and like Parliament Street, and then widen the sidewalks. You know, the potential is there.
It's interesting, Montreal did the same thing with like the plateau of, because they have like borough mayors, but like, the mayor of the plateau was the first one that was sort of a little bit more transit. Their thing was like sidewalks, make streets one way, plant more things, and they got death threats for like a year. And then 4 years later, when the next election came along, they won with a larger majority. And I think that's the sort of, it's who has the courage to do that. The New York, I think there's also a really interesting thing around pricing. So like, I think we have to get into calling it decongestion pricing rather than congestion pricing. But like, it's $9, I think. I don't quite understand how $9 extra has managed to drop traffic so much when things like the Holland Tunnel, if you're paying with an easy pass, it's something like $14 to go through it. So like, it's sort of interesting, but it's like actually incrementally not that much more, but it's massively reduced. Like the people who are driving that, like let's be honest, they can mostly afford another $9. And they're going, no, darling, we're not going to pay another $9. Let's get the path into, or the like NJ Transit, or we'll get into another way. Because it's not like they're not going there. They're still going to see a show. They're still going for work or not from New Jersey. Or so I think there's like something really interesting around, like, you actually don't have to go that far, but you have to have the bravery to go and do it. And then once you've done it, it becomes a bit addictive and you get that momentum and you can do more.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at the last election for the mayor in London, he's done so much and he just won, like, it wasn't even close.
Yeah.
And I think he's too, if you say that you want to make the city healthier and more enjoyable, then maybe, you know, you provide 5 to 7 ways in which you'll do that, and they mostly revolve around making it easier to walk, making it safer to bike, allowing, you know, new small businesses to open. I think those are things that most people like, even no matter what side of a political spectrum you're on, like, everyone loves, you know, people love to be able to go to a nice restaurant or go for a walk through a park. You know, those are things that I think are very appealing, and that politically they keep winning.
I want to touch on the micromobility thing.
Okay.
Because I think we have this thing of people getting their heads of micromobility equals scooters, which is not entirely correct. But also, like, we see scooters often as this sort of like menace on a street. We've all seen somebody riding an electric scooter too fast as well. But we have this thing where, like, by the time often we allow these things to take place, we haven't thought through, where do you park them? Where can they ride? How fast can they ride? What does the street environment look like? And there's a reason why, like, cities that are quite good for cycling tend to be quite good for scooters, because they dedicate more of the space to you people are walking at, you people are ambling on the sidewalk, you people are trying to get on tram. You other people are moving with the last guest I had in this, we were talking about like the sort of trajectory that you look into when you're like riding a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not looking 6 feet in front of me, I'm looking 60 feet in front of me. And I think there's something really, really interesting around, like, you have to create the immediate environment where micromobility can work. But when you do that, it's awesome. And it's even better when that micromobility is connected into other forms of transportation. So people will complain that, like, well, I'll get the GO train, but it'll only get me as far as Union. And I actually want to go somewhere that's not on the subway line. Maybe I want to get to Parliament. Parliament's not that. It's just far enough away where walking from Union's a pain.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, like, we don't necessarily have the transit system to sort of get you from Union to that bit of the city, which is then what leads people to drive. And to me, that's where, like, micromobility, if you have, like, the right street layouts, your point talking about how you do that between Bathurst and Parliament, and then if you do that with the right services and then integrate those services, you end up in you see how you move around the city in a radically different way.
Yep.
And I think that that's something that's interesting.
Oh, I think you're 100% right. I think ultimately, yeah, it comes down to the infrastructure that's put in place for it. Because if I'm going to Union Station and let's say you know, I want to go to Parliament Street, or I want to go to Trillium Park, and I know that there is a bike path to get there where it's pretty uninterrupted and it's pretty safe, and I can get there maybe in 5 minutes biking when it would take 20 minutes walking. Everyone's going to choose to bike because it's more fun, it's enjoyable. And that's also where having pedestrian only streets makes a difference, because then the person knows, like, oh, okay, this is actually a 20-minute walk, but the bike share system is going to have bikes right outside of Union Station. You know, I can just bike right there. It's going to be safe. It's going to be quick. And I'll do that. I think everyone would prefer to do that if given the opportunity. And then the other part is, too, that if you have pedestrian-only streets, you know, like a front street or Esplanade or any of these streets, when someone comes into Union Station, they might be like, you know what? It's a 20-minute walk, but I'm walking through this area with all of these local small businesses and all of these vendors. Like, that's an experience in itself. That people are like, oh, okay, now instead of, oh, I was planning to go to Union Station and then walk to a restaurant for lunch, I might walk through this pedestrian-only street where there's 20 different vendors and I can stop and get a hot chocolate and get a sausage and maybe I see a necklace I like. Like, it creates this whole experience of being there, interacting with different cultures, which people are naturally drawn to. which is why people go on vacation and do things outside of their current environment. And so building the infrastructure for where from where I live, one of the reasons is I know I have a protected bike lane and a kind of trail path to get right down to Trillium Park. So I'm going to choose to do that every single time over driving, unless it's, you know, like a thunderstorm or something. Creating these, and similar for, I think, anyone going on Palmerston or Tecumseh Street, anyone, you know, wherever there's a path, people will be like, oh, I can just, it's going to take 15 minutes to drive. It's going to take 15 minutes on the streetcar, but I can take the bike and it's 5 minutes uninterrupted. And then I can park it right next to the restaurant where I'm visiting my friends, or right next to, you know, the shops. And so I think the Toronto bike share system is really awesome and I love it. And I'm glad they're expanding, because I think that's a great example of that connection to public transit. I think micromobility, whether it's bikes or scooters, is the same kind of thing. It's just a matter of having the infrastructure, and then having an easy thing to do is just remove the last parking spot on any street where a car would be, and just put like barriers up and make that parking for bikes and scooters. It doesn't have to be micromobility. It could be personal bikes and scooters. And then someone's like, boom, I can go bike there. I can meet my friends for, you know, for lunch.
There's something really interesting about the Toronto bike share, because when I first moved to Toronto, like, you saw there were green P bikes. They weren't tangerine. They were like, they didn't stick out quite so well with the green versus the orange. But the pricing never felt quite compelling enough. So they always felt like a thing, like a tourist hops on to like go and poodle around like the waterfront. What you've now noticed is, like, I feel like they've got their sort of annual pricing done way better, to the point where, and is that because it's expanded a bit more, like the amount of people just using it as their day-to-day way of getting around. Or if, like, I used to live on line two, line two would go down all the time. But like when line two went down, the rush of people to go and get to the bike share, because that's the next best thing as a way of getting around, like, it builds a resiliency into the city. And I think, like, it shows how it can work really, really well. It can then change people's behavior.
Yeah.
You hit on the next thing, which is actually, like, scooters are often a menace because they just get like left around. But when you try and, like, a lot of places, they overthink where you can park them, and then they lose their utility. So that thing of all the last parking space on that strip, like, actually make that a place where you can leave a shared scooter, or you can park your own personal bike safely and securely. Like, big thing, like, a big issue with cycling is that the Dutch understand bike parking. Whereas, like, we just think of, like, chain your bike to a fence and hope it's still there when you come back.
Yeah, I think having abundance of parking makes all the difference. And if that is how you solve the issue of tidiness, the issue of things ending up on the sidewalk, knocked over, it's super easy to do, especially because frequently the last parking spot is actually not, there's a sign that says you can't park there because it creates a blind spot for people turning. And so that, to me, is such an easy win right there. Like, make it get clear, bike parking only, put those in across the city is super easy. And I think, like, even a great example to me right now is, if you're in Trinity Bellwoods Park, there's a street called Strawn, which goes down to the water, and it has like a painted bike lane, but it doesn't have a protected with like a barrier. And to me, it's super simple, where, like, anyone who lives around Trinity Bellwoods Park, if that was protected, now knows that, okay, I want to go down to the lake. I can go through the park. There's no cars. Then I've also got this protected route all the way down to the lake. And so I think that's the thing that Montreal does super well. There's a ton of protected routes through the city that will take you to destinations you want to go to. And I think my hope is that the city council and Toronto leadership realizes that if you create that kind of network, people will start doing that instead of driving, because it's more enjoyable, it's more convenient, you don't have to worry about parking, it's cheaper, you don't have the stress of driving. And so, like, if you can, you know, and we've done a good job with Adelaide Street, Richmond, there's a bunch actually now, but creating an interconnected network where the person who could take the bike knows they'll be safe will change people's behaviors. And it already has, and it will continue to, as long as we continue to build, you know, like, going to St. Lawrence Market, I don't think there's, like, I think Front Street is actually a great example, where if you did Front Street from Bathurst all the way across, you could connect the Well, connect Stack Market, connect Kensington Market, connect Union Station, right? Four destinations that are very popular, and now people can bike there safely. that would, you know, be really beneficial.
I want to ask you, like, when, like, working in the field of micromobility, where are the cities that micromobility types look at and go, oh, that's the one that we point to, or that those are the ones that we think have done things really, really well that other cities can learn from?
I think the, you know, I think it's Paris and London. Those are the two that have just done a really good job of creating an environment where it is very easy to for people to change their behavior. And scooting, biking and using scooters and walking are just so convenient that I think that it's really benefited those cities. And those are the two that I think. And then Amsterdam, of course, Amsterdam and some of the cities in the Netherlands. That's a little bit different because it's all like it's more privately owned biking, privately owned bikes versus shared. But still, Amsterdam is definitely Amsterdam, Paris and London, I think, are the top three.
Cool. Like the one I always think to is like Berlin, but I think that's because I went there a couple of times in the not too distant past. And like their bike lanes are weird because they put their bike lanes kind of on the sidewalk. So if you're not from Berlin, it would be like weird. Like you can very easily walk in a bike lane. But I thought they did dockless bikes quite well. So it's easy to find limes and tiers around the city. And they were like relatively, like Germany, like relatively well organized in terms of where you park them, where you can and can't park them, the infrastructure. And then like how you use them as like in a sort of way to go between places. The subway doesn't quite work, or the U-Bahn doesn't quite work for. Last question, the magic wand one. So you've been in Toronto for 6 months or so now, but if you had a magic wand, what's the thing that you would do with your magic wand to make Toronto even better city to live in?
I would probably, yeah, I think the things that I would do are I would make Queen Street and King Street pedestrian only from Bathurst all the way to Parliament Street. And then I would make Yonge Street pedestrian only from College all the way down to the waterfront. If I could do anything, that's probably, I mean, there's tons of things that I'm sure if I wrote it down, I would love, those are the three things that I would love to the most. And pedestrian, I mean, they have streetcars. So streetcar/pedestrian and bike only.
Yeah.
And then Yonge Street doesn't have a streetcar, but I would pedestrianize Yonge Street while going all the way down. It has subway already going from probably, yeah, from Bloor. Actually, from Bloor Street all the way down onto the waterfront. So you would just have a direct path, you know, where you could walk down to the water.
That should be a way of revitalizing Young, so that's for sure. Oh, I mean, also feel like, I know a few people that have been up for all about that, but I feel like I'd enjoy making them get.
Yeah, and actually there's a great example. In Lisbon, there's a street called Rue Augusta, which is basically pedestrian only, and then it ends at this huge central square where they have a big statue.
I know the one you mean.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, there's people there all the time. There's local businesses, and this would be like even longer. And yeah, it would be great. It would be great for the city.
There's a culture of like, it's a European Asian thing of, in the evening you go for a walk, like a sort of purposeless amble around the city.
I love it.
Maybe you get food. Maybe you get an ice cream. Maybe there's some street vendors. I don't know. I think it's fascinating watching cities that do that. And Montreal does it, like, I remember like coming to Montreal during a snowstorm a few years ago, and all along St. Catherine, I think St. Catherine, but like the street was closed, it was snowy, and people were looking at like light fittings and all these installations. And it was like, it's minus 10, it's snowing, and people are out doing this. Meanwhile, people in Toronto would be like, look at the wall. And I think it's like, it's not that people in Toronto can't do the snow, it's but like we don't go and create the place where you'd actually want to spend time in.
So, oh, yeah. Well, and people, yeah, people will go. If the space is there, they'll do it.
Exactly. Arthur, thanks so much. It's been awesome.
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, it's been great.
You have like a different perspective that I really appreciate.
Awesome.
As always, thank you for listening. Really appreciate you getting to this point. If you did, please do like, share, rate, review, all the things that make this podcast go further and farther. And we'll be back with more around like transit and trees and different small cities very, very soon. So thank you very much. Cheers. Bye.